This is an iHeart podcast.
On the Jordan Harbinger Show, you'll hear amazing stories from people that have lived them, from spies to CEOs, even an undercover agent who infiltrated the Gambino crime family. You're about to hear a preview of the Jordan Harbinger Show with Jack Garcia, who did just that.
My career was 24 out of 26 years was solely dedicated working undercover. Now I walk in, I'm in the bar. Now there's a barmaid there, good looking young lady. She's serving me a drink. Hey, what would you like? My drink was, give me a Kettle One martini, three olives, glass of water on the side. I finish the drink. The guys come in. I'm going to go in my pocket, take out the big wad of money. Bam, I give her $100. If you're with the mob, I say, hey, Jordan, you're on record with us. That means we protect you. Nobody could shake you down. We could shake you down, but you're on record with us.
For more on how Jack became so trusted in the highest levels of the Gambino organization, check out episode 392 of The Jordan Harbinger Show.
This is The Jesse Kelly Show.
I want you to imagine something. There are five, we'll call them tribes. Call them Indian tribes. It'll be easy for you to picture that. Five tribes. They've been around a long time. They sometimes are at peace. Sometimes they're at war with each other. Various alliances, so on and so forth. But here's the catch, and it's a big catch. There are no weapons. There are none of any kind. Not even a rock, not a stick, not a spear, absolutely nothing. So the wars, as you can imagine, are not that bad, right? What would it be like? It's just a big brawl. You've either been in one or you've seen one. You know what one looks like. When one tribe goes to war with another tribe, no weapons. Guys come back from their war and, yeah, there are some bloody noses, black eyes, maybe an occasional broken bone or two. Undoubtedly some concussions, you know, the injuries like that, but that's what it is because there are no weapons, right? And it's gone on like this for hundreds of years. This is how they do it. Now, I want you to imagine war is brewing again. They're going to have another big war, another one of these big street brawls. And all they've ever known are these things and no weapons. Only somebody drops off a bunch of crates of swords in each tribe. How does that next war go? It's absolute carnage, right? Probably everybody dies, right? Why? Because nobody in the history of mankind, according to these tribes, had ever developed any kind of tactics, any kind of strategy for this. Nobody. That weird little scenario I just painted for you, it's happened. And it was World War I. You have heard me say several times, but I'm going to say it again here as someone who completely nerds out on history stuff, especially battles and wars and what happened here from all eras. I mean, you know, how all over the place am I? I'm all over the place. We'll go right from Sparta to the Revolutionary War to World War II and back to Alexander. We're all over the place. And I'm going to make a statement, and because I can't actually put myself there, I don't know if it's accurate, but I know it's how I feel. If I could pick one war that would be on the top of my list of places I would not have wanted to fight in, it would be World War I. In the history of mankind, I'm not joking. I realize how scary the swords and spears era is. Totally, totally legit. World War I is a living hell. The battle we're going to talk about today, actually, it's sometimes famous because one of the guys who fought there wrote a poem about it and actually said, "I died in hell." They called it Passchendaele. You will know the battle as either Passchendaele or the Third Battle of Ypres. I know it as the worst place in the history of mankind in this given time. An absolute living hell. I would encourage you, as I often do, as long as you're not driving, go ahead and look up the Third Battle of Ypres on an image search. And Ypres is not I, it's Y-P-R-E-S. Y-P-R-E-S, Third Battle of Ypres. And you don't have to do any extensive stuff. We're going to talk about it today. Just look at it. Look at it. It looks like something out of a science fiction novel. It looks like something out of The Lord of the Rings. It legitimately does. Or one of those space movies where they land, Avengers, where they land in some horrible alien planet. That's what it looks like. All right, before we get to that, though, let's do a little brief background and build up here. First of all, we know how it started, the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand. He was Austria-Hungary's guy. They're now mad at Serbia because it was a Serb who did it. Austria-Hungary issues an insane ultimatum to Serbia, saying essentially you're going to give me your firstborn, your wife, your mother, and both your kidneys. It's a diplomatic version of that. Serbia turns to their good buddy Russia and says, "These guys are starting stuff. If they start stuff, you're going to jump in." Russia says, "Oh yeah, we got your back." Austria-Hungary sees Russia doing that. They turn to their good buddy Germany and say, "Hey, these Russians are starting stuff. If they start stuff..." Now you see where we're going. Now we're in a war. Stuff got started. War started in 1914. 1915 was, again, even though that's not where our battle is going to take place today, one war would be World War I, the one I never would want to fight in. The year specifically of World War I would be 1915 on the Western Front. It just, ugh. And here's where we are, fast forwarding to 1917. Germany is starving. The country itself quite literally is starving, because the Brits and their wonderful British Navy have been blockading Germany. You know, Germany's, you know, it's big, it's nice, it's fertile, but you cannot possibly supply armies like this and a society like this and survive. So they're hurting for supplies, they're hurting for food. They are still, by this point in time, probably the finest army in the world. There are many people out there who think the World War I German army is maybe the greatest army that ever exist. Wonderfully trained, excellent tactics, some really great generals. They're amazing. And remember, just because I say Germany, this is World War I. This is pre-Nazi Hitler era. Well, kind of pre-Hitler. He actually fights in this war and is a decorated war hero, I should point out. Isn't that so funny that the good and bad of people? Hitler turns out to be the worst person who ever lived, probably. Whereas if you just rewind back to World War I, Hitler's saving people's lives in no man's land. Amazing, isn't it? Anyway, I don't want to get sidetracked. By 1917, Germany's hurting. Russia, well, Russia's not hurting. Russia's pretty much finished, because what's happening in Russia, you Jesse Kelly Show fans, at 1917, what's happening? Communist revolution. Russia is collapsing on itself. Russia is about completely out of the war. Britain and France, well, they're not doing great either, but France has a major, major, major problem. All right, hang on. The new cybercrime out there sweeping this nation is home title theft. And I have to be totally honest with you. Before it was brought to my attention, I never even knew this was something that existed. You see, your home title, it's online now. It's all digital. And these cyber criminals today are amazing what they can do online. I mean, disgusting, but amazing. And what they do, they get a hold of your home title. They make it look very, very real, getting your signature on your home title. Then they take a loan out against it. Guess who gets the bill? This crime is so huge, the FBI is freaking out about it. You might already be a victim of it and not know it. Go to HometitleLock.com, register your address, then use the code Jesse, get 30 free days of protection. HometitleLock.com. Start protecting your finances. Start doing it now. France has a bigger issue at this point in the war, 1917. And here's their problem. Well, problems. You see, people forget World War I. Obviously, it was a world war. So there was, you know, some fighting in Italy. I don't mean to dismiss that at all. There was some ferocious fighting in the mountains in Italy. There was fighting in Turkey. There was fighting in Africa. You know, there was fighting in different places. Fighting in the Eastern Front. But the Western Front, the trenches, the bulk of World War I, as you see it when you picture World War I, did not take place in Germany. It took place in France. These trenches are in France. France is the one having to endure things like Verdun. Verdun was that massive artillery battle that just destroyed an entire area. You see, France is feeling this war personally. Their young men are being slaughtered. Remember, more Brits, Frenchmen, and Italians died in World War I than died in World War II. The scale of this conflict and carnage is horrible. On top of all this, France has all this loss of life, all this loss of her precious national property that she's very proud of. France is a proud nation. Much as we like to make fun of them, they're a very proud nation with a lot of history, great history. And now, it wasn't only Russia dealing with the commies. You see, France had a gigantic socialist uprising in their army. It was an ideology that was spreading across the world at this time. It wasn't only Russia. And France was dealing with sometimes entire units essentially pulling a mutiny and deciding, we're done fighting. Screw you. And the generals would have to go basically bow down. People don't know this history, but generals would have to go bow down and sometimes, oftentimes, didn't even charge the men, would give them more time off. That's how you know it was a big problem, because this was the era during this war, this was the era, and every time before this, you don't fight, fine, you get lined up against the wall and shot. And they did that too during to some of the mutineers, but lots of them, they just let them off. On top of that, France had just done one of the things we're about to see Britain do. One of the things Germany did several times. They all tried to do this. You see, this is the situation in World War I. Everybody knows it as trench warfare, trench warfare, trench warfare. And that's true, but it's more than that. It's not just trenches. It's not just a trench. Well, we've got our trench here, and then there's no man's land in between us, and then your trench there. How it works is, if you're the Germans, and everyone was doing this, but as an example, if you're the Germans, you have a trench. Your trench gets more and more fortified every single day. They would dig rooms into the side of these trenches. The Germans, because they're freaking Germans and they're just like this, the Germans would wallpaper the things. I mean, you would build a complex inside your trench. So you've got your trench. Your trench is decked out. And then you go out of your trench and go backwards towards your headquarters for a ways. And then there's another trench. And then backwards another ways, and then there's another trench. And they would start doing things, they call it defense in depth, where once you break through the first trench, things actually get more difficult as you go along. The defenses stiffen even more as you go along, and both sides were doing this. And so what does that mean? Well, it means this. If you have your battle line and their battle line, it's not different than swords and spears. You want to break through it in some way so you can then flank them and attack them from behind, or charge clear through it and go seize some critical objective that'll screw them all up. You've seen it in the movies 1,000 times. Hold the line, hold the line. It is really, really important nobody gets through your lines, because once they're through, you are not set up to defend from the other direction. They can attack you from the rear. You have to defend both sides. It's a nightmare. So whether it's swords and spears or World War I, you're trying to break through the other guy's line. And both sides would try this repeatedly in World War I. And for the most part, it never worked, because they didn't understand how to properly use all these new toys, all these new war toys. So they couldn't ever maximize it. And instead, remember those swords from the beginning? Instead, they would just throw men against the line, which is, of course, what you would do throughout the history of the world up to this point. Only now, there is that thing called a machine gun there in a concrete pillbox, and your valiant cavalry charge is only going to get you, all your men, and all their horses killed in about 5 seconds. There's nothing valiant about it. It's idiotic. However, it's, again, the only way they've ever known. Let's charge them. And all the men die. Let's do another charge. And another men die. And they're trying to break through these lines that really cannot be broken through. And at this time, 1917, France had recently done one under a guy named Nivelle. It was called the Nivelle Offensive. And just like pretty much all of them, as they tried to break through this gigantic offensive, we're gonna hit the Germans here with all this artillery and all this and that, and we're gonna break through and finally get them. And it grinds to a halt like all of them do. Even if you seize some objective, you've lost so much, you're virtually wiped out. And that's where France is at this moment. You see, Britain, when they won a battle, When they want to fight this third battle of Ypres, they go to France, thinking they're going to get some help because they're allies, and France is all, no, you're fighting this one on your own. We are in bad trouble. So France is out. Germany, their situation is this. On top of the starving and everything else, they now have pretty much brought the United States of America into the war, even though we're not really there yet. And how do they do that? Well, it's an interesting question because we get into rules. What rules should be? What rules should you follow? How long do you follow them? There were and are obviously rules, international rules, Geneva Convention stuff, against a submarine or any other naval vessel firing a torpedo into the side of a normal non-military transport ship or passenger ship. Those are the rules. And I think from a surface level, we would all agree that's a good rule, right? We don't need China firing a torpedo into a Carnival cruise ship. Would seem a little inhuman. But there's a flip side to that. Hang on. Got another great night's sleep last night with Ebb Sleep. You need an Ebb Sleep. It is not drugs. Stop putting sleeping pills, chemicals into your body. Stop doing that to yourself. Even though you're going to get to sleep eventually, it's not natural sleep. It's not good sleep. Your body needs natural sleep. And look, I know what you go through when you lay down at night. I know why you can't go to sleep because I've been there. You lay down and what's going on? Your mind won't turn off, right? It's not that you don't have enough covers. It's not that this or that. Your mind doesn't stop. You think about the day you had. You think about the day you're going to have. Ebb Sleep goes after that problem. It actually targets the root cause of why you can't get to sleep. It's why I love it. Go to tryebb.com/Jesse. That's tryebb.com/Jesse. Use the promo code Jesse at checkout for $25 off. The other side, the flip side of that coin, unrestricted U-boat warfare. The flip side to it is, you're Germany, they're blockading your ports. You have to do something to starve the British, don't you? They're allowed to starve you and your civilians? Because rest assured, it's not just the army starving. The citizens are starving. So again, we like to make it all black and white, good versus evil, but are they wrong? It's easy for us to side with the British because we have more of an affinity for the Brits than we do the Germans for the most part. It's because of our history. Are they wrong? Germany's looking around all, they're starving us to death. Screw them. Let's starve them. There were arguments about this. It's not as if we always like to act like, and I do this too, we act like the whole country agrees on one thing whenever we're talking about things countries did in the past. There was massive argument in the Germans, you know, in the German government about whether or not to do unrestricted warfare because they knew it would probably bring us into the war because inevitably you're going to end up killing some American citizens, which of course they did. But that's the way it is. Now, on to Passchendaele, the third battle of Ypres. understand that war is starting to get a little more political when it comes to divisions of power. Now, when I say starting to get, war is always political to some extent. What's that great von Clausewitz line? War is a continuation of politics by other means. But now, here's the situation in Germany, or in Britain. You have a man, Douglas Haig. He is the big general in charge. You have Lloyd George. He's the prime minister of Britain. So technically, he's running the show in the country. They are starting to have major, major disagreements. And Douglas Haig, well, I'll put it to you this way. There are several books written after World War I by Brits who fought under Douglas Haig who consider him to be a monster. A cold, unfeeling monster. Everybody's heard of the Battle of the Somme. It took place before this where one day, 57,000 Brits dead. That was Douglas Haig's doing. He was one of the guys. He was the guy. If you're in a battle, in a war like this, you hate his guts because he at least seemed, who knows what's in a man's heart, he at least seemed like he didn't care at all about people dying, about his men being slaughtered. He didn't care. Douglas Haig wants to push through, wants to have a big battle at Passchendaele. Lloyd George, the Prime Minister of Britain, wants to attack somewhere else. Let's attack down in Italy or something like that. And so, again, it's weird. It's hard to put yourself in those shoes because this was the era where they were trying to figure out who should be calling the shots. I mean, part of the reason why you want civilian leadership is so you don't end up with this. There's no question who the commander-in-chief is. It's the president, period. In this era, in Britain at this time, they didn't have that quite worked out yet. And so it turns into, tell me this wouldn't be awkward. You've been at war for 2-3 years now. The worst war by a mile in Britain's history. It's a total carnage, disaster. They begin having a war in the press about where they should attack next. Imagine that here. Imagine we're at war with China. And Mattis is still in the government. And Donald Trump wants to attack up through Mongolia. And Mattis wants to attack down around the Korean Peninsula. And they begin lobbying various press outlets in America to talk about how great one strategy is or the other. And I don't mean subtly. I mean openly and blaming it on the other guy. Douglas Haig wants to do this. What an idiot. Can you believe Lloyd George wants to do this? What a moron. Isn't that about as awkward as it comes? Haig wins. And because of how this whole thing turns out, that's going to be about the last time Haig wins. Haig wins, and Passchendaele it is. Now, here's what you need to know about Passchendaele, and this part is critical. Those of you who looked it up when I told you to do a little image search, this will make a lot more sense to you. If you haven't done that yet, it's a great time to do that now. It was originally, if you can believe this, looking at that absolute hellscape, it was originally some of the most fertile ground out there. The topsoil was just dark and rich and had been supplying, it had been amazing farmland for centuries, for as long as anyone could remember. It was incredible farmland. That was before. You see, there was something else about Passchendaele that made it uniquely terrible, in the history of warfare. The water table was only 18 inches under the ground. 18 inches. Now, what's taking place during World War I? Artillery. Artillery like the world had never seen. Gigantic artillery shells blasting out huge holes in the ground. And I don't mean one here and there. I mean everywhere, and landing in the same place over and over and over and over again. And remember, this is the third battle of Ypres. Third battle. They have taken this once fertile farmland, as you can see from the pictures, and it has turned into one gigantic mud bog. Mud like you can't see. The ground wasn't ground. If you're looking at the images of it, or even if you're not, I can describe it to you. They had to set up wooden walkways and planks everywhere so you can get to and fro, so you can get in and out of a place. There's one horrible, absolutely horrible story. The story goes like this. Men would drown in it. You understand, men would drown in the mud, and not only that, you would watch them drown slowly in Passchendaele. There's a terrible story. Dan Carlin told it in his Hardcore History podcast. This unit is walking out. They're walking towards the front. And when you're marching towards the front, you oftentimes have people marching back towards you or back your way during World War I. And sometimes, lots of times, it's not whole units. One guy would be sent back because the whole unit's either dead or they could only send him back. And as this unit's marching towards the front, they come across this guy. Hang on. This unit was walking out towards the front. They come across the young man by himself. Again, this is not abnormal to come across somebody by themselves during this time. And this young man is stuck in the mud up to his knees. And he's sinking very, very, very slowly. They attempt briefly to get him out. Do not consider them to be inhumane. When you are told you have to get to the front, you have to get to the front right now. There is a time schedule. They try as best they can on the way by. They have to leave him there. He's begging them to stay. They came back from the front 2 weeks later to find him with only his head still sticking out of the mud. He'd gone insane, as you can imagine. People died there that way. Can you imagine slowly sinking to your doom, watching people walk by? Multiple accounts of men asking, begging to be shot rather than slowly drown in the mud. And you have to know, of course, I'm sure it happened. How'd you like to have to make that decision? How'd you like that on your conscience the rest of your life? Walking by, maybe somebody you know, maybe somebody you don't. Jesse, please shoot me. How'd you like to have to make that call? Remember when I told you it was a hell? On top of that, you deal with this. I already told you about the shell holes in the artillery. This area is a nightmare now. Well, the shell holes, sometimes you can't see them if there's too much water on the ground and you step into them. And if you step into them and they're deep enough, you are dead because there's no way for people to get you out without falling in themselves. And I don't want you to picture some crystal clear shell hole either. There are almost undoubtedly already dead men and or dead horses in it, rotting in the bottom of it. There is poop in it. There's pee in it. There's who knows what else in it because men use them as latrines. And you get to sink to the bottom of it and drown because you couldn't see it. I don't mean it happened once or twice. And if you want what has to be one of the most miserable stories I've ever heard in my life, get this one. During this battle, one portion of it, it had actually dried out a little bit. By the grace of God, the rain had dried out. And it was a day where lots of the shell holes, the water table went down and the shell holes were emptier in this particular area. During the day, they do this attack. Of course, men die in droves and are wounded in droves. And when you are wounded on that battlefield, oftentimes there's nobody there to get you, nobody to pick you up with a stretcher. You make your own way back, or sometimes you have to lay there until nighttime and pray for someone to get you, or sometimes people don't get you at all. So if you're laying out there in no man's land with artillery shells and machine gun fire and you are severely wounded, where are you going to crawl? You are going to crawl into a shell hole because it offers at least some protection. And so men all over the battlefield crawled into the shell holes, extremely wounded. Nighttime fell, and all of a sudden the whimpering and yelling and wailing and praying got a lot louder and a lot more desperate, and the guys back in the trench figured out what was going on. These horribly wounded men who had crawled their way into shell holes were watching as the shell hole slowly fills up with water. All the men were dead by morning. Can you imagine such a nightmare? Forget how horrible it would be to be in that shell hole, wounded, scared, cold, feel the water coming in. That's a whole different kind of hell. What's it like listening to that? The guys who write about it say it just mentally broke people in the unit. Absolutely mentally broke people in the unit listening to it. Now, the purpose of Passchendaele, in case you're wondering, was again to break through. And we've told enough horrible stuff about it for a minute. There is something really, really kind of cool battle-wise that happened here. You see, one of the main goals of Passchendaele was to take this ridge, a ridge where the Germans were dug in and dug in heavily. Now, what's a great way to take a ridge if you can't seem to bomb them off the top of it? You can't seem to charge up the hill and get to them. You can't drop air power on them. What's the other way? I'll tell you in a second. Birch Gold. People, I don't know if you've seen the news. I'm sorry to be the one to break it to you. States are locking down again due to coronavirus. I'm not making that up. I understand that's going to upset some of you, but my word, if you still have all your money in a 401k or IRA that's got stocks and bonds, what are you thinking? You know this only ends one way, right? You understand there's no way this economy can hold its value when this economy is closed. Find out about a precious metals IRA from Birch Gold. They're there to make sure your finances are safe. And this business has an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau. Go to birchgold.com/Jesse. That's birchgold.com/Jesse. If you're trying to get some people off of a ridge and you have time on your hands, which they did, what about going underneath them? Now, remember, I said you needed time on your hands, and this is the third battle of Ypres. They've been here for some time now. The Brits, in one of the coolest, most innovative things I've heard of in my life, decided to mine and tunnel underneath the ridge. They mined underneath it and filled it up with, I forget the exact number, a gargantuan amount of explosives. And then they set it off. And it is, to this day, I believe, outside of the atom bomb, the largest man-made explosion in the history of mankind. Supposedly, whole German units were just vaporized off the top of the ridge. I mean, it's not funny, but it's kind of awesome. Hang on.
Jesse Kelly Show. This is the Jesse Kelly Show.
They blew up the ridge, permanently altering it. You can still see it to this day. Isn't that wild? And Passchendaele went the same way they all went. They would attempt a breakthrough. The Germans would beat a orderly retreat. They did this on purpose. Make you work for it. Retreat in good order. As soon as you've advanced 500 yards, 1,000 yards into where our first line used to be, we wait until you're exhausted, outrun your supply, and then we counterattack. And it went back and forth like this for the entire war, and it went back and forth like this the entire time in Passchendaele. It's funny, Passchendaele is actually a tiny town. And eventually, the Brits actually did take it. I mean, I guess you can call it a win. But, man, they estimate roughly 250,000 casualties on each side by the time the Battle of Passchendaele was done. Maybe the worst place in the history of the world. Why did they fight it? Why did they? I mean, this was one of many breakout attempts, trying to push through, trying to break through the line. This had been years they'd been doing this already. Why do Another one. Why attempt another one? Even Douglas Haig, even if people don't like him, even if he's a cold, unfeeling monster, why do another one? And that's the question people ask so much when they look at World War I and the unbelievable failures of leadership, of tactics. How can you constantly throw men against the same machine gun pillbox and watch them all die and then turn around and order the next one? And here's why that question bothers me. That question bothers me because it shows human beings still do not have a fundamental understanding of leadership, people in positions of leadership, generals, presidents, senators, congressmen, governors, CEOs. You tell yourself, and I do this too, you tell yourself, that guy in this position should be there. Is there based on merit in some way? The truth is simply this. I have had the chance in my lifetime to mix it up with the highest of the high when it comes to powers. Not the president, mind you, but everybody, Speaker of the House, generals, CEOs, billionaires, I've had a chance to hang with any of them from time to time. And the one thing that is almost universally true is I walk away not with a negative impression of them. Some yes, some no. Some really liked, some I didn't like. I walk away thinking, that guy is average. He's just average. Maybe he worked harder. Maybe he had an idea nobody else did. Maybe he caught a great lucky break. Somebody noticed him. Maybe he got an inheritance. Maybe he took a big chance you didn't take. But you always assume that people who rise to these levels are somehow more capable super geniuses than you are, and therefore they have to know what they're doing. Douglas Haig may be a soulless monster. He knows what he's doing. These other generals attempting these stupid breakouts, it didn't work, but they know what they're doing. Most of those guys are average. Most of those guys look at this new thing called the machine gun, artillery, poison gas, and they don't know what to do with it any more than you do. And we tell ourselves, especially when you're marching into battle, literally or otherwise, you tell yourself, because it is a comfort, the people in charge know what they're doing. Even if you don't like them, they have access to more information than I do. They're using it. They have advisors. We'd love to say that to ourselves. I know you do it because I do it too. Well, no, he's got advisors. He would never make that mistake. He's got advisors. No, his advisors. The advisors are idiots too. You like to imagine the man is an expert. Or if the man's not an expert, then he has an expert right next door to him who has it all figured out. And the truth is, they don't have it all figured out. What we have right now in the United States of America with this insanity, with this somehow almost universally agreed upon insanity, leftist commie front groups, Black Lives Matter, burning down American cities, right beside Antifa. Politicians either actively cheering it on in the case of the Democrats or in the case of the Republicans, too scared to speak out strongly against it and stop it. We have corporations sending out Black Lives Matter things. NBA's talking about letting players put social justice messages on their jersey instead of their names. Universities, major universities, sending out Black Lives Matter hashtags when it's a commie leftist front group that's a slush fund for Democrats. Everyone knows it. And nobody seems to want to put a stop to this insanity. And the frustration I hear from people is, why aren't they doing something? Why isn't anyone doing something? How are they not doing something? And here's something you're just going to have to bone up to. Me too. These people aren't that capable and aren't that smart. The ones we follow, even the ones we cheer for, the truth is they're just men. They're just flesh and blood. They put their pants on the same way you do, the same way I do. They're no different than that idiot general, Douglas Haig of yesteryear. You think he's capable? He's a general. Of course he's capable. You don't know how much butt he had to kiss to get there. You don't know if he was the chauffeur of the right general. You don't know if his dad knew a guy who knew a guy. You don't know. I don't know. But just because somebody holds a position of power does not mean they are capable to lead you. Oftentimes, they are not. We have a dad crisis in this country, and we have a major, major leadership crisis in this country. That's the bad news. The good news? Somebody's going to step up and fill that vacuum. Hope it's the right person, because somebody is going to step up and fill that vacuum. Hang on.
You know, your house smells. Don't get mad. Don't get mad. My house smells too. I'm not indicting you. I'm sure you keep a clean home, but just time means you're going to acquire smells, whether those are cooking smells that get in your paint, your carpet. Maybe they're animal smells. Maybe you're a smoker or someone else was. Just living creates smells. I didn't realize that my home had a smell to it until I got my first Eden Pure Thunderstorm, the greatest air purifier I've ever owned in my life. This thing, I had it plugged in for 2 hours. I came back in the room and my air smelled so clean. I now own three of them. I'm not making that up. This thing has absolutely changed me on top of what it's done for my allergies. Go get one. Get two. Be like me and get three. Go to EdenPureDeals.com. Make sure you use the promo code Jesse. That gets you $10 off and free shipping. EdenPureDeals.com, promo code Jesse.
This is an iHeart podcast.